Now, when we think of the Arab world, we often think of oil, politics, war, civil unrest. It's easy to forget that people living there have to go about their daily business. They have to go to school, go to the doctor, have to be able to get clean water. Dr. Abbas El Zain is an associate professor in environmental engineering at the University of Sydney. He's also a writer. His works include a new collection of short stories, Secret Maker of the World, and also a memoir, Leave to Remain. That one won the New South Wales Premier's Award back in 2010. Abbas El Zain joins Anita Barrow in our Sydney studios. So, Anita, what kind of stories do we find in this new collection, Secret Maker of the World?
Michael, Abbas El Zain has drawn stories and characters from all corners and ages of the globe, but they're instantly recognisable. They range from a businessman who spies a much-hated former headmaster on a plane to Dubai, a medieval Arabic geographer who maps his survival, and then there's the young sniper who contemplates his target from his high perch in Beirut. These stories, they surprise and sometimes confront the reader. Abbas El Zain, welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
I suppose, Abbas, what struck me in that story, Fields of Vision, about the sniper, is that here's a boy sitting there with his rifle in Beirut on top of a building who carries all that sullen arrogance and sexual frustration of any teenager, and essentially he's got no real belief in what he's doing and he's killing people. His field of vision, in a sense, is in fact very narrow, isn't it?
Yes, it's the where he is, what he can do, that seems to matter more than why he does it. You know, the war started when I was 12 years old, and I remember seeing a picture in the papers of a naked man lying on the ground, and the caption said that this was the Holiday Inn Hotel sniper. The building where he operated had been overrun by the other side, and presumably he has been thrown from the top floor, or what was left of it. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to see in this story is, what is it like to be lying around, standing just all day, spending it just walking around and choosing your victims and just shooting them without knowing all those victims.
Absolutely. And of course, he makes his little nest there, doesn't he, with his mattresses.
That's right.
And he makes a world.
That's right. And he's a solitary figure. And there's something about snipers. It tends to be a very particular kind of job. It requires technical skills. It is solitary. So I think it makes for a particular character too.
And it has a sort of a sense of reality because presumably because you lived in that world while this was all going on in Beirut.
That's right. I mean, I hope that this is where the sense of place becomes important. And in this particular case, absolutely. I see him very much as almost as a product, as a creation of this particular place at this particular time.
You talk about the sense of place, but there's one that you kind of make up, and it's about a man whose life unravels. It's really a very playful, satirical piece. He's the mayor of this town who likes all the trappings and the plumage of his position. Would you say this is a story really about the dangers of too much self-belief?
Yes, and too much self-blindness too. I think our ability to read ourselves, I think, is and to read the world around us. And I think our ability to read our memory is part of our ability to read ourselves. And this is a question that certainly is important as far as a character in this story is concerned, in that he seems to lack that ability.
That's something else that reoccurs that's related, I suppose, which is, in my mind's eye, this idea of a mental visual perception. It's present, I think, in one of my favourite stories, Bird's Eye. Can you briefly describe that story? It's based on a real historical figure, isn't it?
That's right. So the story is based on a medieval writer called Yaqut al-Hamawi. Hamawi is in reference to the city of Hama, which is in today's Syria. Sadly, it's a city which is very much in war at the moment. He was a boy in Byzantium, in modern-day Turkey. So he grew up a Christian boy, and one day a raiding Arab army abducted him, and he ended up being sold as a slave in Baghdad. His owner ended up sending him to school because he saw promise in him. And eventually, when he became a teenager, he freed him. So Yaqut became a trader himself and then became a writer and a copyist. He traveled a lot and he ended up in the city of Merv, which is in Central Asia, a city that was invaded. It was around the time, we're talking here, by the way, he was born in around 1170 and died around 1230. Around the time that the Mongol conducted their famous invasion, which was quite incredibly traumatic event in that part of the world. Oh, by the way, he ended up writing a very interesting book called The Compendium of Countries, which is a five-volume encyclopedic work arranged by alphabetical order of cities. So you open the book and you could go and check this particular city, and he tells you all sorts of information about that city. Information of geographical nature, but also of historical nature, some of the mythologies. And the book survived. The city that he escaped, Merv, did not survive. It is story of him around in Merv planning his escape before the Mongols arrive and reflecting on his life, essentially, at this particularly dramatic moment. He loved Merv.
He knows it so well. He sort of treks around the town and he's kind of mapping the city and mapping his memories of the city and he's experiencing. He becomes most, he says, closest to Sakina, which I think is a kind of tranquil state.
Yes,
right?
yes. It's a great word. It's a great Arabic word. And it's tranquility, but it's tranquility that has perhaps a spiritual connotation. It's a tranquility that you achieve. It's not a tranquility that is likely to disappear straight away because you've worked hard to achieve it.
And I guess that in some ways there are little themes throughout some of the stories. I mean, they're all very different. But there is things from about triggers, events that change a person's perspective or their mind's eye in some way.
I agree that I see the strongest thread, overarching theme, is that they're all characters that have just lost something or about to lose something that is incredibly important. It's almost as if they've lost something of themselves. And I think, despite the difference in places and time that the stories cover, I think there's always this question about why they've lost what they've lost and how they've lost it. And that tells us something about the world in which they live, but also how they deal with the loss. And that's more about who they are.
That's really very evident, I think, in the story of His Other Cloak. This is about an ambitious Anglican cleric living in the colonial times in Newcastle in New South Wales. He's a man who's grappling with not just the self, but kind of layers of self. He sees himself as a kind of a hierarchy of skins, you write, of garments, who slips into his various roles. So he has to lose some of those skins if he's to survive.
That's right. We see him, like all the stories in the book. That's one of the things I like about short stories, is they've got an intensity that is to do with a very specific time frame and a very specific place. And like the other stories, in this case, Mr. Drake, the priest, is just walking around his parishioners and talking to them. But we also have access to his inner thought, and we find out slowly that he harbors a dark secret. It's about a relationship, a sexual relationship with an Aboriginal boy.
Called Savvy.
Called Savvy, a name that was given to him by the town to which he was brought. So what we get to see is how Mr. Drake reads both his position in New South Wales and his relationship, and also in the context of something bigger. He has a faint awareness that he operates within the British Empire, that he's got a role to fulfill, that he is part of a bigger providence. I think what's interesting about this character is that he's obviously intelligent. At the same time, this blindness, of course, that is precisely to do with his reading, of this illicit relationship. He's aware, though, but he has a capacity to justify it to himself that I think is disturbing. This is a darker story.
It truly is darkest. And I have to say, when I was reading it, I couldn't help thinking about the current Royal Commission into sexual abuse in institutions, including the church. There was a sort of an insight into the way a perpetrator might justify their actions or might think about it.
That's right. I think this is, again, there's an element of, just like when we were talking about the mayor, despite the obvious intelligence, but at the same time, There's a blindness there. There's a parallel between the way in which we in the 21st century might read an abusive relationship between a white man and an Aboriginal boy, the way we might read it politically. He does read it politically, but he reads it in a positive way politically.
You come from a religious background, don't you? Your grandfather
I do. I'm a non-believer myself. I come from a line on my father's side, from a line of religious scholars. So my father was the first in that line not to become a religious scholar. He went and studied at university and became a lawyer.
Did I read somewhere that your mother can trace her lineage right back to the prophet?
Yes, you have to see that in its context, absolutely. So there's whole clans, family clans, that are known to be connected to that lineage. How accurate it is historically, who knows? And she comes actually from a lineage of religious scholars as well. So here you go. I had it both sides of the family.
And yet you chose to be a non-believer, although I imagine culturally you probably...
I think it's that itinerary was quite typical, if you like, in that I was growing up in the city in a very mixed environment, very secular. I went to a secular school.
French school, was it?
French school, secular French school. And Beirut is an incredibly mixed city. So, and by the way, my family had, you know, religion was light. I mean, I was taught to pray and to do the right thing and so on. But there was never any sense of coercion. And then in teenage, in the way you rebel against your parents and against your childhood beliefs, like a lot, and quite a few of my friends went through the same phase as well, and I think that was it.
Did you learn, in terms of this very scholarly background, presumably, though, a sense of honour, ethics was instilled?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know whether I can claim that as a child I learned more than the next child. Certainly what I can say is that books and writings were very important. I write because I love writing. I wake up usually every morning and work for about half an hour or an hour on my writing at 6 o'clock. I find it an incredibly good start of the day. I find putting words on page and trying to imagine words is a way of understanding the world. One thing, for example, that I've explored in my memoir that is to do with perhaps brings me closer to what you're saying is my grandmother was killed by an air raid when I was 15 or 16 years old. And one of the questions that I asked myself in my memoir when I was telling this story is to what extent, as an engineer myself, becoming an engineer later, to what extent the engineers who designed those aeroplanes are responsible for the death of my grandmother. So I think growing up in Lebanon and experiencing violence, you know, growing up in war, I think, puts you in a position where these questions have an urgency, have a persistence to them.
Sydney writer Abbas El-Zain speaking there with Anita Barrow. Lots to think about there, isn't there? El-Zain's new collection of short stories is called Secret Maker of the World, and his 2009 memoir is Leave to Remain, and they're both published by UQP.